Hello, ladies and gentlemen. This is Dan Trotter, Pretty Good Bible Studies. I am now going to cover the second half of Psalms 105. I will call this second half of Psalms 105, The Psalmist Remembers the Exodus. In our previous audio, I covered the first half of Psalms 105. We mentioned how the psalmist wanted God's works to be made known because a remembrance of history is quite instructive for people who are trying to live a moral life in the present. And so the history of Israel has a very, very serious didactic purpose. And so the psalmist is continuing with that purpose in the last part of the psalm. He's trying to show how faithful God was to work miracles to get Israel out of bondage in Egypt. There is no heading to the psalm, so we don't know who the psalmist is. I will just refer to him as the psalmist. Now, in the first part of Psalms 105, we had just finished at verse 25, the story of Joseph in Egypt and how God had been so providential in saving the covenant people from extinction in Egypt. And now we jump ahead to the time of Moses, and that's where we'll start in this psalm, starting at verse 26. He, that's God, sent Moses his servant and Aaron, whom he had chosen. We're still in Egypt where Joseph was, so the place has not changed, but the time has. 400 plus years later, God sent Moses his servant and Aaron, whom he had chosen. Aaron, of course, was Moses' brother. Now, Moses is a type of Christ because Moses led his people out of bondage in Egypt, and Jesus leads his people out of bondage to sin. Both of them were chosen, verse 26 says, both Moses and Aaron, because God chooses special people to do special tasks. We go down to verses 28 through 36 of Psalms 105. The psalmist continues, He, that's God, sent darkness, and it became dark. For did they not defy his commands? He turned their water into blood and caused their fish to die. The land was overrun with frogs, even in their royal chambers. He spoke, and insects came, gnats throughout their country. He gave them hail for rain and lightning throughout their land. He struck their vines and fig trees and shattered the trees of their territory. He spoke, and locusts came, young locusts without number. They devoured all the vegetation in their land and consumed the produce of their land. He struck all the firstborn in their land, all their first progeny. Now, of course, this is all a description of the 10 plagues on Egypt, of which I'm assuming we are all aware. The only two plagues that are omitted are the fifth plague, which was pestilence in the cattle, and the sixth plague, which was boils on the people. But all the other eight are mentioned. We start with the darkness. It became dark. That was the ninth of the 10 plagues. Exodus 10:21, Then the Lord said to Moses, Stretch out your hand toward the sky, that there may be darkness over the land of Egypt, even a darkness which may be felt. That's dark darkness. Verse 29, God turned the Egyptians' water into blood, turned it into blood red. That was the first plague. Exodus 7:19, Then the Lord said to Moses, Say to Aaron, Take your staff and stretch out your hand over the waters of Egypt, over their rivers, over their streams, and over their pools, and over all their reservoirs of water, that they may become blood, and there will be blood throughout all the land of Egypt, both in vessels of wood and in vessels of stone. Now that blood, of course, might not be literal animal blood or human blood, but the red water of the Nile, which looked like blood, could be some kind of infestation of animals, sea animals, which are water animals, which turn the water to blood, but at any rate, they couldn't drink the water, so this is serious business. You take away a nation's water, and they are cooked. The fish died in verse 29. The fish couldn't drink it either. Verse 30, their land was overrun by frogs. That's the second plague. We read that in Exodus 8, verse 3. The Nile will swarm with frogs, which will come up and go into your house and into your bedroom and on your bed, and into the houses of your servants and on your people, and into your ovens and into your kneading bowls. You think, well, that's just mere inconvenience. That's not so bad. Wait till those frogs die. The stench will be absolutely unbearable. I've smelled dead frogs before. And to think that the whole nation, your bed, your eating utensils are covered with dead frogs, that's a nasty plague. Verse 31, the psalmist continues, God spoke and insects came, gnats throughout their country. This is the fourth plague. Now, the Holman Christian Study Bible translates the Hebrew word as insects. The New American Standard Bible says it was flies. Let me read from the New American Standard Bible in Exodus 8:24. Then the Lord did so, and there came great swarms of flies into the house of Pharaoh and the houses of his servants, and the land was laid waste because of the swarms of flies in all the land of Egypt. I like that translation better because flies is just awful. Insects is bad too, but flies is really bad. Apparently nobody knows exactly what the Hebrew word meant. Gnats are also mentioned. KJV has the word translated as lice. NIV, the NASB, the Holman Christian Study Bible all translate the word as gnats. So we'll assume it's gnats. Flies and gnats all throughout the country. The flies were the fourth plague. The gnats were the third plague. Exodus 8:16, then the Lord said to Moses, say to Aaron, stretch out your staff and strike the dust of the earth, that it may become gnats throughout all the land of Egypt. Gnats and flies, or gnats and insects. We go now to verse 32. The psalmist continues, God gave them hail for rain. In other words, the rain froze up into hard round balls of ice, and there was lightning throughout their land because lightning often comes in tandem with hailstorms. Verse 33, God struck their vines and fig trees and shattered the trees of their territory. That's because of the hail. The hail wrecked the vines. It wrecked the fig trees. It shattered the trees. That's generic trees, just all the trees of their territory. Hail can really do a number on things. I've been through a hailstorm before, and it wrecked my roof. And so hail's serious business, especially to an agricultural people. The hail was the seventh plague, as recorded in Exodus 9:18. Behold, about this time tomorrow, I will send a very heavy hail, such as not been seen in Egypt from the day it was founded until now. So this was not just an ordinary hailstorm. This was hail. I mean, I've seen pictures of hail that are inches and inches in diameter, big old balls of ice falling out of the sky. And of course, as I said, the hail was accompanied by thunder and lightning, because thunder and lightning often accompany hailstones. And the psalmist explicitly mentions lightning in verse 32. Lightning came throughout the land of the Egyptians. Let me read you the NASB translation of Exodus 9:23. Moses stretched out his staff towards the sky, and the Lord sent thunder and hail, and fire ran down to the earth. The NASB uses fire for lightning. That's an alternate way of translation. You often see fire. It translated as lightning and vice versa. Now, I mentioned that the Egyptians' vines were destroyed in the hailstorm. This is recorded, actually, in Psalm 78, verse 47. This is a psalm written by Asaph. God destroyed their vines with hailstones and their sycamore trees with frost. So that psalm is referring back to the Exodus 2. The detail about the vines being destroyed by hailstones is not in the Exodus, but it is in this psalm. So we can add that to our knowledge about the plagues in Egypt. Exodus 9:25 tells us about the trees that are being destroyed, twice mentioned in verse 33 of our Psalm 105. Exodus 9:25, the hail struck all that was in the field through all the land of Egypt, both man and beast. The hail also struck every plant of the field and shattered every tree of the field. Next up, after hail, which was the seventh plague, next up is the locust, which is the eighth plague. The psalmist mentions this in Psalm 105, verse 34, God spoke and locust came, young locust without number. They devoured all the vegetation in their land and consumed the produce of their land. We read about this eighth plague of locust in Exodus 10:12. Then the Lord said to Moses, stretch out your hand over the land of Egypt for the locust, that they may come up on the land of Egypt and eat every plant of the land, even all that the hail has left. Now our psalmist says in Psalm 105, verse 35, that the locust devoured all the vegetation, just as was recorded in Exodus, and the locust consumed the produce of their land. That's the Holman Christian Study Bible translation, produce. That sounds like something you get at the grocery store. I don't like that translation. The NASB has the fruit of the trees. In other words, the peaches or whatever is growing, the apples, whatever's growing on a tree, pears, got wiped out by the hail. So vegetation gets wiped out, fruit of the trees gets wiped out. In other words, everything is wiped out by the hail. And if that's not enough, we see in verse 36 that God struck all the firstborn in their land, all their first progeny. And of course, this is the famous 10th plague. God saved the worst till last. We read about the 10th plague in Exodus 11:5. And all the firstborn in the land of Egypt shall die, from the firstborn of the Pharaoh who sits on his throne, even to the firstborn of the slave girl who is behind the millstones. all the firstborn of the cattle as well. Now, Psalm 78, which I've already mentioned, written by Asaph, also mentions the death of the firstborn. Psalm 78:51, and smote all the firstborn in Egypt. God did that. The first issue of their virility in the tents of Ham. Ham is Egypt. Of course, the author of Psalms 105 could be quoting Psalm 78:51, or he could be just referring straight back to Exodus. The firstborn of the Egyptians were killed. We need to remember also the firstborn of the cattle were killed, because the firstborn emphasizes the strength, the posterity, the strength of a people as the family name is passed down from generation to generation. God hit the Egyptians where their flesh claimed strength, and God destroyed their strength. The NIV has it this way. Instead of firstborn, they translate the first fruits of all their manhood. I like that. God destroyed the first fruits of all their manhood in the 10th plague. We go down to Psalms 105, verses 37 through 41. Then God brought them out with silver and gold, and among his tribes there was not one who stumbled. Egypt was glad when they departed, for the dread of them had fallen upon them. He spread a cloud for a covering, and fire to illumine by night. They asked, and he brought quail, and satisfied them with the bread of heaven. He opened the rock, and water flowed out. It ran in the dry places like a river. In verse 37, the psalmist says that God brought the Israelites out of Egypt with silver and gold. How did he do that? Well, it's because the Israelites borrowed silver and gold from the Egyptians, but they didn't pay them back because they had left the country. Now, this was justified because the Egyptians had held them in slavery. God had actually predicted this back when he gave the covenant to Abraham in Genesis 15. We read in verse 14 of that chapter, "But I, God, will also judge the nation whom they will serve," that's Egypt, "and afterward they," the Israelites, "will come out with many possessions." So God actually mentioned that little detail in the famous covenant chapter in Genesis 15. So God brought them out with silver and gold, and among his tribes there was not one who stumbled. Verse 38, Egypt was glad when they departed. They didn't care about losing their silver and gold. They were glad to see him go. We read in Exodus 12, verse 33, "The Egyptians urged the people to send them out of the land in haste, for they said, 'We will all be dead.'" When you're about to die, you don't care about the Israelites not being able to pay you back with all the silver and gold that they had taken. Verse 39 in Psalms 105, "God spread a cloud for a covering and fire to illumine by night." This is the famous pillar by day and fire by night. We read in Exodus 13, 21 through 22, "The Lord was going before them in a pillar of cloud by day to lead them on the way, and in a pillar of fire by night to give them light, that they might travel by day and by night. He did not take away the pillar of cloud by day, nor the pillar of fire by night from before the people." Now in verse 39, it says the cloud was a covering. Now we often think of this pillar of cloud as something upright, like a pillar, and it was leading the Israelites. But here, verse 39 says the cloud was for a covering. Gill mentions the problem by saying this: the cloud, quote, "seems to have been in an erect posture and to go before the children of Israel to direct them in their journey and not a covering to them." So what's the answer to this? Well, one possible answer is that the cloud covered the Israelites when the Israelites rested, not when they journeyed. We read in Numbers 10, verse 34, "The cloud of the Lord was over them by day when they set out from the camp." So when they set out, it was a pillar of cloud, but while they were camped, the cloud covered the Israelites like a canopy. Now some other scriptures back that up. We read in Isaiah 4, verses 5 through 6, "Then the Lord will create over the whole area of Mount Zion and over her assemblies a cloud by day, even smoke and the brightness of a flaming fire by night. For over all the glory will be a canopy. There will be a shelter to give shade from the heat by day and refuge and protection from the storm and rain." Now that's referring to Mount Zion at the end of the Exodus, or when Israel had gotten established in Jerusalem, so that might not quite be apropos, but the reference to a cloud by day and a fire by night does sound like it's talking about the Shekinah glory that accompanied the Israelites on the Exodus. And you notice this cloud by day and fire by night is mentioned by Isaiah in chapter 4. This cloud and fire will be a canopy, which is like a covering. Well, we can go straight back to the Exodus, Numbers 9:16, and read this. So it was continuously, the cloud would cover it by day and the appearance of fire by night. The it that the cloud covers is referring to the tabernacle when you look at the context. And so I think that verse nails it. The cloud covered the Israelites when they were camped. When they took off, the cloud formed a pillar, and the people followed God in that cloud. Continuing in Psalms 105, we read in verse 40, they asked, and he brought quail, and satisfied them with the bread of heaven. So here's the quail and the manna. Verse 39 in Exodus 16:13, we read about the quail. So it came about at evening that the quails came up and covered the camp, and in the morning there was a layer of dew around the camp. The layer of dew was the manna. Now these quail that were provided by God eventually cloyed. The Israelites got sick of the quail, and they sinned. Numbers 11:19-20, we read this. You will eat not for 1 day, or 2 days, or 5 days, or 10 days, or 20 days, but for a whole month, until it, the quail, comes out of your nostrils and becomes nauseating to you, because you have rejected the Lord who is among you and cried to him, why did we ever leave Egypt? You know, that's really something. Talking about looking a gift horse in the mouth. God keeps you from starving to death, gives you quail, and then you start complaining because you want the leeks and the garlics of Egypt. At the end of verse 40, the psalmist says in Psalms 105 that God had satisfied the Israelites with the bread of heaven. That, of course, is manna. Manna is, I think the scholars say, a substance which is named, what is it? They looked at it and they'd never seen it before. What is it? We read about this in Exodus 16:14. When the layer of dew evaporated, there were fine flakes on the desert surface, as fine as frost on the ground. That's the bread of heaven. We read in Psalm 78, the psalm by Asaph, which I've quoted several times already, Psalms 78, verses 24 through 25. He, God, rained down manna upon them to eat and gave them food from heaven. Man did eat the bread of angels, because angels are in heaven and the bread came from heaven, so it's the bread of angels. He sent them food in abundance. The actual story of the manna is in Exodus 16. I'll read you a couple of verses out of that chapter, verses 31 and 32. The house of Israel named the substance manna. It resembled coriander seed, was white, and tasted like wafers made with honey. Moses said, this is what the Lord has commanded. 2 quarts of it are to be preserved throughout your generations, so that they may see the bread I fed you in the wilderness when I brought you out of the land of Egypt. In verse 41, the psalmist continues in Psalms 105, he, God, opened the rock and water flowed out. It ran in the dry places like a river. That happened twice on the Exodus, 2 famous instances. Before I show you those 2 places in the Old Testament in the Pentateuch where the 2 splittings of the rock occurred, let me read you 1 Corinthians 10:4. And all drank the same spiritual drink. Paul is referring to the Exodus. All drank the same spiritual drink, for they were drinking from a spiritual rock which followed them. And the rock was Christ. So Paul takes the incident of the splitting of the rock, and they say, ah, see, water came from the rock. That water gave you life. Well, there was a spiritual rock, Jesus, following them, and he was giving them spiritual drink. We read again from Asaph's psalm in Psalm 78, verses 15 through 16. He, God, split the rocks in the wilderness and gave them abundant drink like the ocean depths. He brought forth streams also from the rock and caused waters to run down like rivers. Now let's look at the 2 instances where God did that. The first was at the beginning of the Exodus at Rephidim, which is right on the approach to Mount Sinai, Exodus 17:6. God says, I am going to stand there in front of you on the rock at Horeb. Horeb is Mount Sinai. When you hit the rock, water will come out of it and the people will drink. Moses did this in the sight of the elders of Israel. Now this place where Moses did this was called Meribah, which means quarrel, and it was called Massah, which means testing, because the Israelites had just started out on the Exodus and they were short of water and they were quarreling with Moses and they were testing Moses. And God also. So Moses did that, and that had a happy ending. But later, at the end of Exodus, at Kadesh Barnea, we read this, Numbers 20:11-13. Then Moses raised his hand and struck the rock 2 times with his staff, so that a great amount of water gushed out, and the community and their livestock drank. But the Lord said to Moses and Aaron, because you did not trust me to show my holiness in the sight of the Israelites, you will not bring this assembly into the land I have given them. These are the waters of Meribah. Meribah means quarrel, where the Israelites quarreled with the Lord, and he showed his holiness to them. Now, this famous incident of Moses striking twice with the rock when he was told to only strike it once has led to a great deal of theological speculation and controversy. I'm not going to go over that again. I did so when I was in Numbers 20. That's the bad news for Moses and Aaron. They can't go into the Promised Land. But the good news for the Israelites is they got water again. And, of course, they're quarreling. We don't have any water. We should have gone back to Egypt. We move now to Psalms 105, verses 42 through 45, and we will finish this psalm. For he remembered his holy word, that's God. God remembered his holy word with Abraham, his servant, and he brought forth his people with joy, his chosen ones with a joyful shout. He gave them also the lands of the nations, that they might take possession of the fruit of the people's labor, so that they might keep his statutes and observe his laws. Praise the Lord! God, in verse 42, remembered his holy word. What holy word was that? The holy word he made with Abraham, his servant, and the famous covenant with Abraham in Genesis 15. Genesis 15:18 reads this way, "On that day the Lord made a covenant with Abram, saying, I give this land to your offspring from the brook of Egypt to the Euphrates River." Of course, the famous holy word, the covenant, the oath with Abraham, not only included the land from the Euphrates to the Wadi El Arish down there at the border of Egypt, but it also included descendants to fill the land, seed, and a blessing to all the nations coming forth from that seed. That is indeed a holy word. The whole structure of the Bible is based on these covenants. And so in verse 43, God brought forth his people with joy. That means he brought the Israelites out of Egypt with joy. It's always a joyous thing to escape slavery. His chosen ones with a joyful shout. Verse 44, God gave them also the lands of the nations. Ah, here's where the skeptics start screaming and hollering. How is this fair for the Israelites to commit genocide and to wipe out those Canaanites and to steal their land? God is an unjust God. I can hear these morons screaming now as they prepare for their trip to hell unless they repent, as they blaspheme God freely with no fear. The answer to this is that it's God's land. He can distribute it as he will. As John Gill said, the Lord did it, who had a right to do it, being the possessor of heaven and earth. So that's the first answer, is God can do what he wants to with the land, just like he dispossessed Adolf Hitler of Germany. Well, that leads to the second answer. The dispossessed Canaanites were being punished for their sins, as John Gill and the NIV Study Bible point out. And we need to point out that the Israelites were dispossessed of the land too in 586 and also partially in 722 B.C. by the Assyrians and 586 B.C. by the Babylonians because of their horrible sin. God can kick people out of their possessions anytime he wants if he wants to punish them for their sins. And remember, these Canaanites, these dispossessed, marginalized people, they were sacrificing their kids to idols. They were participating in the grossest form of idolatry. But we, in our sanitized habitations in the future, we can't imagine that sort of stuff going on, but it was going on. Not to mention the typical murder and rape and all that other stuff that people do, but it's mainly the idolatry. You sin against the God who made the universe. There's a certain payment that's due. It's called death. Let's look at some scriptures that show us some of the characteristics of the Canaanites who were dispossessed. Leviticus 18:21. God says, "You shall not give any of your offspring," he's speaking to the Israelites, "you shall not give any of your offspring to offer them to Molech, nor shall you profane the name of your God. I am the Lord." Molech, of course, was the idol to which people sacrificed their children. Some people say that passing through the fire was not an actual sacrifice. They would just take the baby and kind of give the baby as a wave offering to the idol. They would just push the baby forward between the two arms of the idol, and there was a fire under those two arms, and then pull the baby back. I don't believe that. I believe they were sacrificing their kids, and God says, don't do that. Well, so there you go. You feel sorry for those Canaanites now because the Israelites whooped them? Numbers 25, verses 1 through 5. While Israel remained at Shittim, the people began to play the harlot with the daughters of Moab, for they invited the people to the sacrifices of their gods, and the people ate and bowed down to their gods. So Israel joined themselves to Baal of Peor, and the Lord was angry against Israel. Now those verses show how prone the Israelites were to idolatry. It didn't take much to seduce those suckers, because they didn't really love God. Verse 4, the Lord said to Moses, "Take all the leaders of the people and execute them in broad daylight before the Lord, so that the fierce anger of the Lord may turn away from Israel." So Moses said to the judges of Israel, "Each of you slay his men who have joined themselves to Baal of Peor." Now, I just mentioned these two verses to show that idolatry is a serious, serious sin, and the result of that sin is punishment, and the punishment is death. The application I would make today is if you are running after drugs, fame, Instagram clicks, free sex, you're a fool because you are getting paid. Your bank account is being filled up every day by death, and one day you're going to have to cash out. In verse 44, the Israelites took possession of the fruit of the Canaanites' labor. The Canaanites planted, they harvested, they prepared the harvest for winnowing and all that. They did all the agricultural labor, and then, whoops, here come the Israelites to take the people's, to take the Canaanites' crops. In verse 45, God did all these good things for the Israelites so that they might keep his statutes and observe his laws, which they didn't do, and they got kicked out of the land too in 722 by the Assyrians and 586 by the Babylonians. But the purpose was, we're going to get rid of these Canaanites, God says, so that you can go there and obey my laws, and we will establish a just kingdom on earth in the midst of all the immoral filth that the nations are now committing. And of course, the last phrase of verse 45 is, "Praise the Lord." Another way to translate that is, "Hallelujah." Ladies and gentlemen, we have now finished Psalms 105, and we're now prepared to go to Psalms 106. That is also a long psalm, so I'm going to have to divide it in half. We will take up the first 23 verses in the next audio, and I will call those verses, "Israel is rebuked for sins during the Exodus." That's really not a good title. Misplaced modifier. They weren't rebuked during the Exodus. They were rebuked in the psalm for the sins that the Israelites committed during the Exodus. I will see you in that next audio, I hope, and I hope you also enjoyed this one.